Welcome to the Health and Human Services Committee in the Senate for Tuesday, March 20th. We are one short of a quorum, but I thought we would try to at least begin the testimony on the bill, and we're going to trust that one of our members makes their way from whatever committee or business they have been at up to this point. So we have two bills on the agenda this morning. Senate File 687 is first with Senator Senjum. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you. Senator Hahn and members, I will ask that somebody offer an amendment at some point when it's appropriate, and maybe I can briefly describe that. Well, I'll wait till we have a quorum. I would also note, Senator Hahn and members, that I have behind me a group of students from Casa Manorville High School who are here today to learn about how government works, and it was opportune to bring them down and witness this hearing. So it's good to have them.
Senator Senjum, let me interrupt you for just one second. Thank you for bringing the students and welcome, and I hope you have an interesting day here. We do have a quorum now. One of our members just walked in, so I'm going to ask if Senator Nienau would move the A3 amendment as an author's amendment to your bill and to Senate File 687. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. And so now the bill, Senator Senjum, is in the form that you desire, and you can proceed with your presentation.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And the amendment that you just adopted was an amendment that would limit the application of this bill to specimens processed in a laboratory, and most specifically, this relates to Mayo Medical Laboratory in Rochester, to limit those to out-of-state specimens. In other words, specimens received by Mayo Medical Laboratories that come in from, frankly, across the world, across the United States, it would limit to that spectrum of specimens. So it would not count specimens that arise and are processed from patients within the or facilities within the state of Minnesota. As Chair and members, what this is really all about is the provider tax affects these specimens at a rate of 2%. And the argument is, should specimens be taxed at 2% if they do not arise from patients within Minnesota? The claim, or at least the prospect of this particular bill, suggests that they should not. And so the bill attempts to lift from those specimens, those that don't accrue from Minnesota, that 2% provider tax obligation. In the process of doing that, and I'll let Ms. Maria Brown speak more specifically, it would certainly make Mayo Medical Laboratories more competitive, leave more money within the framework of Mayo to use for other purposes, and I think overall be a wise decision. This is one of the only applications that I know of where we apply the provider tax to situations that are outside of our border. With that, Mr. Chair, if I could, I'd like to introduce Ms. Maria Brown from Mayo Clinic, and she is I've known Maria for a long time, so she has advanced through the Mayo process and now carries a very lofty position in the Mayo Medical Laboratory organization. Welcome, Maria.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for our record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Marie Brown. I am the Vice President of Mayo Medical Laboratories and the Senior Administrator for the Department of Laboratory Medicine and Pathology at Mayo Clinic. I'm speaking today on behalf of Mayo Clinic and Mayo Medical Laboratories, or MML, in support of SF 687. This bill would relieve MML of the significant and unique burden of the provider tax, a tax that is imposed on MML but not on our national competitors, because they have chosen not to have operations in Minnesota. MML is currently the third largest reference lab in the United States. We provide high-quality esoteric testing for hospital and medical center clients from around the world that don't have the volume, technology, or expertise to provide this testing at their own site. At MML, we have a philosophy that differs from that of our competitors, in that we believe what is best for patients is that laboratory testing services are located as close to patients as possible whenever feasible. MML, therefore, provides support to help our clients retain vital testing services in their own community while providing access to tests at MML that aren't practical to perform locally. MML employs close to 700 people. Over 500 of these employees are located in Minnesota. MML also has testing sites in Jacksonville, Florida, and Andover, Massachusetts. Additionally, MML supports another 2,400 workers in Minnesota with high-quality technical jobs. Every day, 5 cargo flights deliver specimens from MML client sites into Rochester. The largest of these is from FedEx, a Boeing 727 with a payload of 50,000 pounds that brings MML work into Rochester from around the world. Together with Mayo Clinic, MML accounts for about 40% of the flight. On average, we receive more than 30,000 specimens each day from our clients. We have over 4,000 clients in all 50 states and in more than 130 countries around the world. Through MML, we perform over 12 million tests per year. These tests provide important results to more than 4.5 million patients per year. MML is a for-profit taxable entity. In addition to the other corporate taxes imposed by the state, MML is required to pay the Minnesota care tax on its gross revenues. This additional 2% makes our laboratory less competitive in comparison to labs located in states that do not impose the tax. Our MML clients are very price sensitive, and there is fierce competition in the reference laboratory market, which makes it very difficult for us to pass this additional 2% on to our MML clients. In addition, since all profits from MML go to support the research and education missions of Mayo Clinic, this tax means that there's about $4 million per year that is not available to conduct these important mission-critical activities. SF 687 would exempt specimens that are received from outside of Minnesota from the provider tax. Although we have many clients within the state of Minnesota, 93% of our volume comes from outside of Minnesota. We are asking for help to keep MML strong so that we can continue to be the third largest reference laboratory in the country. We ask you to recommend passage of SF 687 as amended and allow MML to remain competitive and continue to be a contributor to Minnesota's business economy. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brown, for your testimony. I did want to ask one question. You mentioned that your lab facility has sites in Jacksonville and one other location, and I was curious, do those locations also pay this provider tax for the specimens that they deal with at those locations?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I don't know the answer to that. Of the 12 million tests we perform a year, about 400,000 are performed at our testing facility in Jacksonville, Florida, and 1.2 million in Massachusetts. But I'll have to get the answer on
that. All right. Just was curious if that was also applied to the business that was done in the other states.
I'm sorry. No, they do not pay.
They do not. Okay. Thank you. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Brown, if I understood your testimony correctly, you said that this would save the Mayo Research Laboratory about $4 million a year and that you would be able to then use that on research for medical purposes. Did I understand that correctly?
Ms. Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator. Yes, that would be $4 million that we could devote to research across the clinic and education, not just within the department.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Brown, could you give us an idea of the types of research that Mayo is involved with that this $4 million could be used for and put to what I would consider good use?
Ms. Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator. As the funding would go to our research committee at Mayo Clinic, they would determine what research projects, et cetera, would deem funding. And we have a broad base of research all the way from basic science research, detecting new analytes to test for, all the way to research in surgical procedures, et cetera. And it's hard to say at this point where that $4 million would go. We would leave it to our research administration to allocate that.
Senator Newman.
Mr. Chair, just to add maybe a little
Senator
bit, I spent 44 years there, but, you know, Mayo's deeply committed, for instance, to diabetes, deeply committed to cancer.
Heart disease.
Deeply committed to all kinds of heart disease, cardiology research, and beyond that. You know, major facilities are full of people down there working on research, frankly, as we speak.
Yeah. Senator Newman.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Senator Sanjam. You got to the issue that I was trying to get on the record. I wasn't trying to pinpoint where this $4 million would go. I was just trying to get an explanation as to the type of research that the Mayo Clinic does on behalf of everybody in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you. Senator Nino.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question maybe more for fiscal staff than the testifier as the author, but the by example, it's a $4 million save for Mayo, which means it's $4 million not coming in. Is that would end up in the health care access fund? Is that correct? Or currently is going into the health care access fund?
That's a question I wanted to ask too, sir. You know, maybe our fiscal analysts and members, you do have not a fiscal note, but a memo from the Department of Revenue that describes the impact on the health care access fund if this bill were to become law. Now, the amendment that we just adopted removes the impact of this prospective loss of revenue out of the current budget period, so it would be budget neutral for the current budet. So that was one of the effects of the amendment we passed. But I am curious to know, we're showing a $2.6 million fund impact and described as a $4 million impact to Mayo. I just want to know if there was anything we need to know to reconcile those numbers. And do we have anybody, or Dennis, do you have any, or Mr. Albrecht, do you have any enlightenment for us?
Mr. Chair and members, I think the difference in the first year would just be because it's implemented in the middle of a calendar year. And so you can see in the out years it's closer to $4 million.
Okay. That would make sense to me. And certainly no.
And then, Mr. Chair, my other question is, how does this relate to the phase-out from last year's budget?
Mr. Albrecht wants to comment or others, but my understanding, what we did last year is we phased out the provider tax over a period of time, and the phase-out is somewhat conditional on the amount of money that's in the fund, and so it's not a certain path to phasing out that tax. But we did pass a bill last year that would remove this tax at some point, assuming nothing else changes. And so I assume that this would have no direct impact other than perhaps the $2.6 million or $3.6, whatever that amount would be a potential loss of revenue that might need to be picked up in other places. So it might, I don't know that it would extend the phase-out period any great length of time, but there may be others that know more. And I don't know, Mr. Albrecht, do you have any comment on that? So it's a little uncertain because the phase-out period is not defined precisely. It depends on the fund balance.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Sanders,
there may be someone from the department that could testify. The information I have is that in 2014 there will be $141 million surplus in that fund, and so it would seem it could accommodate this $4 million.
Right.
But I will stand corrected if I'm wrong.
And Senator Sanjam, I had been told similar things when I first heard about this bill back toward the beginning of session, that it would have some impact, but probably not enough to change the timing of the phase-out appreciably. Senator Hall.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sanjam, this would only be effective to the Mayo Clinic, though, correct? It's not for all hospitals?
Senator Sanjam.
Or research groups?
Mr. Chair and Senator Hall, Mayo is certainly the predominant player in this. I am not aware of any other, we call them reference laboratories, that do this kind of work. The University of Minnesota quite possibly might do this, but Ms. Erin Sexton is sitting next to me now, and maybe she can clarify that question a little better than I can. Certainly Mayo is the big player in this in Minnesota.
Ms. Sexton, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Erin Sexton, and I'm with Mayo Clinic. And to answer your question, the bill as amended, the initial bill, I think, would have been little unclear as to who it impacts. As amended, it treats all specimens that come in from out of state, regardless of which facility they go to, the same. So, for instance, if Fairview University were to receive a specimen from Wisconsin and do that testing, they would also be eligible for the exemption from the provider tax. But predominantly, it is Mayo Medical Laboratories that does a bulk of the work from that we do get from other states.
Senator Hall.
Do you have, Ms. Sexton, a guesstimate of the percentage of the work that Mayo does versus others in the state?
Ms. Sexton?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hall, I do not. Like I said, I think it's probably the university that has a reference lab and maybe
so
others, but
50,
I don't know
50,
what bulk of, I don't know what percentage of their work comes from outside of state, outside of the state of Minnesota.
Okay.
Senator Hall, any further question, comment?
I'm good.
Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been looking at the A3 amendment, and I think that the language on lines 2, 3, and 4 is kind of awkward and clumsy, and I think I can make it a little more readable.
Senator Higgins.
Would you be amenable to that?
I'm sure that the author would be happy to hear your suggestions, since they usually are very on point.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, we are always favorable towards good language promotes the bill.
Okay, so look at line 3. After the word examine, insert and report results for. And then it continues, a biological specimen. Delete the rest of that line. On line 4, delete examined and insert that. And then the rest of the sentence. So it would be examine and report results for a biological specimen that is collected outside the state.
Seems a little more straightforward to me. I guess I would like to hear any comments from the author or the proponents of the bill.
Ms. Chair, my colleague, former colleague, suggested it works fine, and so that no problem.
Senator Nino.
Well, Mr. Chair, having voted on the prevailing side, I'll move to reconsider the A3 amendment.
All right. The motion to reconsider the A3 amendment has been made. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
Now, Mr. Chair, I would reoffer the A3 amendment with the language just described.
A3 amendment is offered as amended with the language Senator Higgins suggested. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? And the amendment as amended is now on the bill. Thank you, Senator Higgins. Appreciate it. Other questions?
Tom
for
McQueen, that's me. Yeah.
Questions for the Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Senjum. With this change in tax status, does the laboratory expect any growth?
Who's going to do this?
Senator Senjum.
Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, I'm going to defer that to Ms. Brown, who is more directly associated with the business. I'm just going to give you a lay perspective. I think that two things. I think it better enables them to compete, and there's no question this is a very competitive business. And then I couldn't say this when I worked there, but I think it further ensures that this kind of operation stays in Minnesota and doesn't move to Jacksonville or some other out-of-state Mayo site, which would not be at all impossible. We want this business to stay here. So I think doing this further solidifies their reason to continue to do this business in Minnesota.
Ms. Brown, did you have
Thank
any?
You, Mr. Chair and Senator Benson. Yes, we do anticipate that this will help us continue to grow. We do have plans for growth. We have sales staff located throughout the United States and in four areas around the world to continue to sell. As Senator Senjum said, it's a fiercely competitive environment out there. Every dollar matters to our hospital clients and medical center clients. So this will help us continue to grow our business, that we feel that we've got the staff and resources to grow here in Minnesota at this time.
Thank you. Other questions on the bill? Seeing none, Senator Senjum, do you know if this bill... Well, I imagine it would have to go to finance or taxes. Any other stops that you're aware of? I'm not aware of any.
Not by virtue of the coaching I just got. I think it's taxes, and we'll see what Senator Ortman has to say.
All right. Well, members, Senator Higgins.
Why wouldn't it go to finance as well?
It may need to. I don't know, but it does affect the tax policy and the collections, so I assume that that's where it would end up first. They may want to send it to finance as well, but I think it should go to taxes at least. So we'll set it there, and if they deem it's necessary to go to finance, I'm sure we'll see it there as well. So,
Mr. Chair, I think the path out of this committee is finance.
That's true, Senator Higgins, typically, but I think that it would be good to have this be reviewed in taxes before we would send it to finance, so that if they have problems with it, maybe it doesn't need to go any further than that. I don't know. I hope it does, but I guess I feel that it probably should be seen in taxes before it gets to finance.
Taxes is always the last stop, I thought.
Other questions? Sir Laurie.
But just to clarify that a little bit, it is your thinking, too, though, that it should go to finances before, like, appearing in a tax omnibus bill or something and just get a review? I mean, I think that's kind of the point we're getting at, is if it goes to taxes and just gets laid on the table there and never gets a review in finances, that might be an issue. I mean, I think that's what we're kind of trying to get at here. So is that your understanding, that it should be seen in finance?
Well, I'm not the chairman of the finance committee, but I would expect that it probably would be in both places. But my understanding is that the tax committee would want to see this, so we'll send it there and see where it goes after that. Senator Newman, would you like to move the bill?
I would, Mr. Chairman. I would move Senate file. What number we have? 687 be recommended to pass and proceed to the tax committee.
As amended. Any other discussion on the bill? I appreciate, Senator Senjum, you're bringing the bill, and people from Mayo, thank you. We recognize the importance of this issue and would certainly like to be of help. And just for the students in the audience, we hear many bills relating to the Mayo Clinic. We all recognize its importance, and this is just one example of the things that we need to try to do to keep Minnesota competitive and hopefully continue to keep Minnesota a leader in healthcare and healthcare-related issues. So thank you for bringing the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
On Senator Newman's motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you again, Mr. Chairman and members.
And next up, we have Senator Laurie's bill, Senate File 2013. Senator Laurie, Senate File 2013.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We have Senate File 2013 before you. Before we get started, I have an author's A1 amendment, but I think council needs to make an oral amendment to the A1 amendment. There's an improper reference, so maybe we'll get that.
Okay, Mr. Lobeko.
Mr. Chair and members, on the A1 amendment, page 1, line 23, where it says section 245.4871 should read 245.462.
So strike the 4871 and replace it with 462. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chair. In addition, on the same line where it says subdivision 27, it should read subdivision 18.
I'm sorry, 18?
18, 1-8, yes.
And Mr. Lobeko, on line 24, does that also need to be changed, that 4871 to 462?
Mr. Chair, that is right. It's also the same section as above, so 245.462.
And is subdivision 26 correct, or does that also need to be changed?
It's now 17.
17. So the two changes are on line 23, changing 4871 to 462 subdivision 18, and on line 24, again, 4871 replaced with 462 and subdivision 17, correct? Any other changes in the... Senator Laurie moves author's amendment, the A1 amendment to Senate File 2013 as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted, and the bill is before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Okay, so what we have here is some changes to corporate adult foster care services in Minnesota, and these are, you know, a really important and productive partner in our whole service continuum, but they serve a lot of folks with different needs. They serve people with physical disabilities, developmental disabilities, brain injuries, and mental illnesses. And most of the statewide oversight of these within the department is governed by the Human Services Licensing Act and Minnesota rules. And most of these focus on things like the physical environment and residence rights and some of the record keeping. All of the other oversight of these is delegated to the counties. And the counties are required to do three-hour orientation on the Vulnerable Adults Act and general provisions of some of the Minnesota rules. And then they have a list of 26 additional training modules that they may offer. And what results is a lack of really specialized care that's well known for some individual populations, particularly those with mental illness. And last year, in the omnibus bill, we had a provision where these corporate foster care settings, if they were actually successful in reintegrating a client into the community, that bed became decertified. And so we were looking at that and kind of used that as a focal point to realize, you know, truthfully, it's those with mental illness that are most likely to be reintegrated into the community. And we should consider that a success. And it is what we're trying to ask the community, the adult foster care community, to do, is to take these people and give them the skills that they need to be integrated into a lower level of care, more integrated into the community. And with the decertification in particular, it was kind of a real disincentive for them to succeed. And so what this bill does is it does a couple of things. It creates a voluntary system for these corporate foster care providers to become certified as a mental health foster care home. And we have some certification requirements in there with 7 hours of training on key mental health topics, requirement of a mental health professional or practitioner, crisis plans, and really what comes out of this is kind of a good housekeeping seal of approval is what my good friend Sue and I have come to think of it as, so that it gives a signal to the community looking for a good place for these individuals where they can be given the care that they need to really succeed. And so it develops that voluntary system, and the A1 amendment that we adopted just made clear that it is voluntary. When it was first introduced, there was some confusion as to whether all homes would be required to do this extra training and certification, and that was never the intent. So it's going to be a voluntary. If a home wishes to step forward and say that they want to add these additional certifications and be known as one that will be a good home for people with mental illnesses, this allows them the ability to do that. And if they do that, the second part of the bill is then that because we are hoping to have them provide the care that stabilizes these individuals and finds a lower level of care with more community integration, if they succeed in that, their bed does not become decertified. So that's kind of section two of the bill. That's basically an overview of what the bill does. I'm going to open it up for Sue Abderholden to describe a little bit more about how this came about, and we're happy to stand for questions.
Thank you, Senator Laurie. And Ms. Abderholden, welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. excuse me. NAMI actually has long been concerned about corporate foster care, the rapid development, the lack of standardized training, and the lack of transparency in terms of which populations they serve. So last fall, we pulled together a group of providers, DHS staff, family members, and people living with a mental illness to kind of really discuss this issue. We then created a survey, and we distributed it to people who have lived in a foster home, family members, and even staff who've worked in them. And we were able to identify several key areas of concern. First was clearly staff preparedness. Staff had a poor understanding of mental illnesses, there was poor medication distribution, and they treated the residents in a condescending manner. People were concerned about crisis management. Our residents were being sent inappropriately to the hospital and then rejected due to lack of medical necessity. There was police involvement and subsequent arrests and staff, staff incapacity to deal with the mental health crisis. Quotes from the family members include, "My son would disappear and be off his meds for 2 to 3 days. Staff was intimidated by his manic symptoms, and the staff locked herself in the office and called police. They did not get my son to see a doctor when he was very ill, and then there was an altercation between him and one of the staff, so the police came, and he was sent to jail, and he spent over a month in solitary confinement." Based on the problems we identified in the discussion of what happens in homes where there are trained staff, this bill was developed. As far as we know, no one opposes it, and we've worked hard to reach a consensus with providers, the counties, DHS staff. And as Senator Lori said, it really is a voluntary certification. When a nurse or a social worker in a hospital wants to discharge someone, they're going to know that that particular foster care home actually has trained staff, has a crisis plan in place, and then I think that just increases the probability that someone will actually get better. The second section of the bill, you know, is an issue that we found from last year, again, because people with mental illness actually get better and move out, which we think is a good thing. And we want to make sure that those homes don't fall apart because they've lost one quarter of their funding. I think this is a way to make sure that we all know there's not enough options for people with a serious mental illness, so this makes sure that at least those homes that are that have staff that are trained and have those crisis plans in place, that they will actually remain viable. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Aberholt. Sir Lori.
And I know that the department has been working on a fiscal note for this with the amendment as added. That was added in the House. I don't know if they have anything further. They were hoping that it might come through the system in time for us to look at it. I don't know if that has happened.
Senator, I've been advised that we haven't seen that yet, but it's kind of the end of the deadline here. We got another week to go. So I do think this is a good bill. I have had some discussion previously on this. I know there's desire in the other body to move this forward. I certainly share that. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we've got someone here from the department that wants to comment and give us a little update. That would be great.
My name is Carrie Erber, and I'm in the Continuing Care Administration in DHS, Mr. Chair and members.
Welcome to the committee.
The fiscal note is kind of in process right now. I think Dennis is probably making copies of the preliminary note because he got the amendment this morning. And basically, I can give you just a rough idea what's in it. Section 1 has no cost the way it's with the amendment. Section 2 will have a cost, and that's because basically it's exempting the mental health providers from the 2011 corporate foster care rate reduction that was taken last session. And so there's a percentage that has to add back to the savings that was taken last year. So that portion would have a cost.
And any idea of approximately what that estimate is looking like at this point?
It's about in the 150K range.
Okay. Are there questions at this point? I think,
Mr.
Senator Higgins.
Chair, if I...
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Senator Lori.
And the department did come and talk to me and give me a heads up that this was coming, and I'm going to work with them. It is my intent to work with them on that. I mean, I actually think this is, and we've all had problems with fiscal notes. This is a pretty familiar issue, but to my way of thinking, when we have homes that are behaving in the very way that the state is really trying to push them, and we have a home that is being successful and taking someone out of often a higher level of service, taking them into this corporate foster care setting and succeeding in getting them into a step down service, we should be able to keep that bed open and move another person out of the higher level service, and that if that doesn't demonstrate savings, we need to look a little deeper. So, I mean, I think there's probably room for discussion here and really to ensure, and we haven't seen it yet, the assumptions. And actually, I think that the department really does try hard, so I'm not trying to, fault them. But I think I really plan on engaging in this. And my hope with the committee is that we can move forward with this bill, move it out of this committee into finance, and continue to work with the department to try to get that second section to zero. And I'm very pleased that the first section did make it to zero. And I think that, this type of model really should be able to demonstrate it to have no cost or even a savings if we are able to succeed in this manner to move people into lower levels of care, which is the very thing that the decertification was aimed at trying to get providers to do. So
Senator Lori, I agree with you, and I certainly agree with you that the department, I know, is working very hard to go through this process, and certainly respect that. And
yep.
I know that you'll continue the dialogue, but I think your point is, in my opinion, well taken, and hopefully we'll, as this moves forward, get a little more clarity on that. But
yeah.
Senator Higgins, did you have a question?
Mr. Chair, I'm looking on the last paragraph of the A1 amendment.
On page 2?
Yes. And it says that if the certificate is denied or removed, it is not appealable, and that when you fix whatever it is, you can just request certification again. It seems a little... Tell me why this isn't appealable. Is it because it's just, like you said, kind of a good certificate of good housekeeping kind of thing, and there's really nothing to appeal, or why would that be?
Senator Lori, or
that make any sense?
A couple of responses, and again, I haven't seen the fiscal note yet. First off, it's pretty straightforward, the denial. It's not a terribly complicated, and if we when we build in appeals process, there's cost.
It's money.
and we're really trying to get to a zero fiscal note. So, I mean, I think those two together, and the community is comfortable with the fact that these are pretty clear standards that we're asking for, and if they haven't met them, they haven't met them, the corporate foster care community seems to be comfortable at this point without that appeals process in place. So, I mean, I think that's kind of where we are.
Mr. Chair and Senator Lori, the only thing that I question is that it says that you can request certification when you're in compliance with paragraph B.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like an appeal, almost.
I guess all the ones and then the next small... I guess I always struggle with the indentation part of these bills because it's hard to know what's inside anything else. But I guess it is all of those things from like 113 to 129.
Yes.
Is that the ones to be?
I think Senator Marty is trying to refer the committee to that list under number 1 of B. Is that correct? As the criteria.
Mm-hmm.
And then, okay, thank you. But I'm not sure why there's an and there and an and there.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Abdur-Hogan or Senator Lori, are you expecting that any of the homes that are dealing with people with mental illness that might be getting moved to the community will be getting the certification? In effect, I mean, the ones that are most successful would be doing this, obviously. But in the other ones, they'd be losing a bed if they succeeded in effect. So you expect that anybody who is dealing with this population would go through this voluntary. They'd all go through it, I assume.
Senator Lori or Ms. Abbott?
It is a voluntary, so it's kind of hard to predict. But I would think that somebody that wanted to be known as being good at and actually wanted to be good at serving this population, I would certainly hope that they would step forward and provide this training to their staff and have the crisis plan in place and have a good work. This is really kind of a best practices, evidence-based approach to providing the appropriate level of care in a corporate foster care setting, an adult foster care setting for people with mental illness. So, I mean,
Mr. Chairman?
I would hope that they would step forward.
Mr. Chairman, my question was on the linkage of that and the second portion of the bill, because whether they want to or not, in effect, if they are taking this population, they have somebody of success who does move back to the community, they lose a lot of their funding. So, in effect, if you want to do this, whether you want to succeed or not, in order to sustain your funding, you really will be doing. I was just curious why, if that was the sense of what would happen because of the linkage, or, I mean, do you think you won't have as many people getting certified if there's not that linkage?
Senator Lori? Or Ms. Abdul?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty, I actually think in working with the providers last fall that people want to be known as kind of getting that good housekeeping seal of approval. So I think even without the linkage, they would like to be able to do that.
Okay. Senator Hayden, did you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry that I was late. I had another bill with Senator Rosen this morning. But the one question I had, and not to kind of muck anything up, but I know in my district or around it, there had been a lot of concern around ethnicity and cultural competence and those kinds of issues. Did the work group or anybody kind of deal with that issue, both on the side of making sure that they're compliant, that there's some linkage to making sure people need to know, and then secondly, to serving populations that are mentally ill that come from different cultures? Ms. Aberholm, do you know kind of how we've addressed that issue?
Ms. Aberholm.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hayden, it is actually one of the topics of the 24 that any foster care homes can, or that a county can require them to have. So I would imagine that in Hennepin County, for example, that would be one of them that people would have to have training on. But it varies from county to county. But it is one of the mentioned topics in the rule.
Okay. And then, Mr. Chair, so it's one of the topics in terms of, because I'm looking at the list of kind of certifications that people need to have to yes. work with. So I'm just trying to understand.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hayden, what we're trying to do is kind of, we have, you know, all the foster homes have a list of 20, you know, for some topics, and one of them is cultural competency mm-hmm. and cultural differences. But then we were just wanting to make sure that at least people had some training in mental illness to be able to serve people who have a serious mental illness, because we've had people, you know, where they call the police and things like that. So we weren't tackling all of the problems in terms of foster care standards. We were just tackling the mental health piece.
Right, Mr. Chair, and then I'll leave it at this. So I guess what I'm saying is there seems to be some connection between a person that has mental illness and the culture in which they come from, and that there has been issues with people not understanding the two as they work simultaneously, especially if it's from a culture that is that hasn't embraced, if you will, or hasn't really worked with those issues. So, for instance, in the Somali culture, and we've dealt with this not only in mental health issues, but intellectual disabilities, autism, and the likes, that there has been some significant amount of work to try to identify this issue of mental health, not only from the practitioner's point of view, but from the culture that they come from. And so I think you've kind of said that you've talked about it, but it looks like, I mean, I'd also, though I'm not going to add anything to what you're doing, I know you've done a lot of hard work, but I would like us to think deeply of it not just being something that's cursory and around, but that's something that's fully integrated into this issue of, if you come from a culture that has not really dealt with mental health issues, but you have a mental health issue, that the two may conflict.
Senator Lori.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Hayden. I think you do bring up really good points, and I guess I'd point you to kind of the beginning of my testimony, too, regarded the fact that, you know, the state doesn't really intervene a great deal in the competencies, if you will, of the corporate foster care setting. That's really a county function, is one of the things that Ms. Abreu-Holden was kind of getting at. And my hope is that counties like Hennepin that do run into this a great deal more frequently than, say, Pine, would be very sensitive and would pick from this list of 26 or 28 different competencies and really ensure that those needs, those very, very real needs are met, but this is the and should be integrated into the mental health needs too in those communities where it's been recognized as a barrier and creates disparities. So very sensitive to it, and appreciate your question.
Thank you
for raising those questions. Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, I'm looking on the fiscal note worksheet that we just received.
Yes.
And there's a comment in here that there are savings indicated because of first-year reductions in beds that were delicensed. Sounds like a really strange word, but can you tell us how many? Can somebody tell us how many beds actually were delicensed?
Sir Lori, or
I don't think any have been decertified as of yet.
$46,000 worth.
It's all based on. Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins. It's based on projections, and I haven't had time to. Do you have the fiscal note in front of you now, everybody? Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
I haven't had time to totally absorb it, but. But it does make sense that, you know, there were savings from decertifying beds, you know. So the way it worked, you've got a four-bed home, and under last year's bill, if you were, I describe it as successful in getting somebody to succeed in moving out of that bed into the community, you were rewarded with a decertification of that bed, and the difficult task of trying to run that home with only 75% of the revenue, run it on three beds remaining certified. And you know, the fiscal estimate for that provision that passed last year did show savings. And this is getting at an exemption to the decertification. And so, you know, presumably more beds would remain certified and be able to continue to serve this population. And so, you know, I might have an uphill battle working with the department, but I look forward to the conversations as we move on from here, and think that there really is a lot to be said for allowing these well-trained homes to take individuals with mental illness out of typically, you know, higher levels of care than corporate foster care, bring them into a bed, give them what they need to stabilize them and get them ready and prepare them for a more home and community-based service, better integrated with lower care. And that is the core of what we were going at with the even with the decertification. And so I think these should work together, and I will spend more time with the fiscal note and with the department, and, you know, hope to get to a place where we can have a zero.
So, Mr. Chair,
Senator Higgins.
I think this is a question for you then. When we were working on the budget bill last year where this provision got put into it, can you share with us some of the thinking that went around the idea? I mean, we're so short on mental health coverage throughout the entire state, and then to have a provision that once somebody leaves the facility, then you can no longer have somebody else in that same bed. And I suppose it's cost cutting, but it just seems to be not well thought out, or maybe that's too offensive a phrase. I don't know. But can you give us some reflection on
that? I'm going to ask Mr. Lobeko. I think he had some comment on that or some recollection of what was going on here.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and Senator Higgins, this was actually a Senator Berglund provision, suggested provision, and it was in order to, believe, buy back something else. I'm not remembering what that was off the top of my head, but it was a way to.
It came out of the blue to me, so I had no memory of.
Well, and Senator Higgins, I think Senator Lori's making a good point. I don't think that the intent was to try to create this incentive to have people work to help people and then penalize them by putting additional financial pressure. I don't think that was the intent. I think Mr. Lobeko is right. I don't recall exactly the sequence of things, but Mr. Lobeko.
And Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I should have clarified that this was a bill that was introduced, I think, one of the last days of session, and it got into the ultimate, the final bill that passed in the summer. So that was
without this committee hearing it, I tend to forget things that we do in this committee way too often. But yeah. So we didn't have a hearing on it. It just kind of appeared in the budget bill.
I believe this was a request. As I'm thinking back now, I think Senator Berglund did come to me on the floor and suggested we try to work this into the budget, and we did talk with her about it. But a lot of things happened last year that
I think
that many of us don't recall exactly how everything happened last year. So, and many of us don't want to recall. I don't know, but any rate, I don't think that was the intent. Was to try to put homes that are doing good things in fiscal risk. I don't think that was Senator Berglund's intent, and so so I think I've had some discussion with folks in the other body. I believe there is interest over there in this provision as well, and it is moving forward. And we do have a fiscal note that isn't huge, and as I've said, we are going to put together a fiscal bill. Not sure yet what the scope of that will be. Obviously, we want to try to keep it manageable, whatever that may mean. But certainly would encourage continued work on the fiscal part of it so that we can make it as affordable as possible. And Senator Lori, I believe that they were going to put this into a larger bill. Is that your thought, or were you thinking that it would go on its own, or how did you want to proceed?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'd like to try to go alone and see if we can't continue to work on this getting to zero. And if we can't, you know, maybe I'd need to come back to you and ask if there weren't a way to get back into a bigger bill. We call them omnibus bills, don't we? Typically, I mean, I don't know. I have yet to.
Right.
Okay.
Right. That's such a big word.
I know.
we're trying not to have a big bill.
You've danced around it so successfully all session.
It's one of those.
I wonder if we're ready to say the Omnibus Health and Human Service Bill.
I think of that as about a 600-page thing, and I don't think what we're looking at is.
All right. Well, I said it.
It's hard. Can you really have a mini omnibus bill? I don't know. That's. Sir Marty, you had a question?
Mr. Chair, first of all, on that, I think they're called ominous bills.
An ominous bill. All right.
But two comments on this. One is I think that this issue does get to a problem with the fiscal note issue, because I do think getting people out into the community fully on their own instead of in the group homes is a savings, not a cost. But the other thing is whether it's whatever the intent is, whether you call it unintended consequence or not, I think Senator Lori, you described it right. We're basically taking the most successful homes and punishing them and basically going to force them out of business for being successful. That may not have been the intent. I'm sure it wasn't the intent, but it clearly is what happens with something like this.
And maybe we should call it the omnibus bill.
That'll work.
Sir Lori,
I'd like to move that Senate File 2013, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance.
All right. On that motion, and members, just if this does need continued work or consideration, and if it is helpful to bring it back and incorporate it with some other things, we're certainly open to do that. But I don't want to be in the way of trying to get this to go forward. So, Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, in the Environment Committee, we often are running them as a dual track, so you know the motion is to send it on and to lay it aside for possible inclusion in some omnibus bill.
And Senator Lori, are you amenable to that?
I'm absolutely amenable.
She'd
to
like
that,
it to
yes.
go to the Environment Committee.
Yeah, so we're going to send it to the Environment Committee.
Judiciary? I mean, should
judiciary?
We?
Judiciary. I think finance will be sufficient too. Okay. So. On Senator Lori's motion to dual track this on its own and keep a copy here, any further discussion on that motion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Lori and Ms. Abderhold. Members, that's the end of our agenda. We do have a slightly longer agenda for tomorrow. We should be done with the bills that we need to hear this week. I think next week we're going to have at least one meeting where we'll be taking the various finance bills and trying to assemble them into some vehicle. whether it's a bus or a minibus, we'll find out. I also do want to next week take up some bills. There's an exchange bill that Senator Lurie has asked that we hear, and we may have to do that in an evening. But there is the Department of Health has got a DNA bill that we just received. We are going to try to move on that this week. Tentatively, we have that scheduled for tomorrow. I'm not sure if we can squeeze that in or whether we should go into tomorrow evening or carry over to Friday, but I just am trying to alert you to where we're at. I think we should be done with most of the bills by the end of this week, but that DNA bill is a little bit up in the air. We're not quite sure where we are with that one. So that's just the update, and appreciate your consideration, your being here, and we're adjourned until tomorrow.